Good morning and good afternoon, and thank you all for standing by. At this time, I would like to remind all participants that your lines will be placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. This call is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Benjamin Haynes. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Christy, and thank you all for joining us for today's update on the lung injury investigation among people who use e-cigarette or vaping products. We are joined today by CDC's Principal Deputy Director, Dr. Ann Schuchat, who will provide this week's update. Following the update, Dr. Schuchat will be joined by Drs. Christopher Jones and Benjamin Blunt from CDC's response team to take your questions. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Schuchat.
Thanks for joining the call today. As the year draws to a close, based on extensive investigations by state and local public health authorities, CDC scientists, our partners at FDA, and expert clinicians, we are able to make more definitive conclusions about the outbreak of e-cigarette or vaping product use associated lung injury, or EVALI. Some of the support for these conclusions comes from CDC-authored articles being released today in the New England Journal of Medicine, as well as two articles in today's early release of the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. As of December 17, 2019, a total of 2,506 patients have been hospitalized for EVALI, including reports from all 50 states. Sadly, there have been 54 deaths from 27 states. But based on the data being released today, we can make more definitive statements about the trajectory of the epidemic. I want to make four points. First, it is clear that the outbreak represented a new phenomenon and not recognition of a common syndrome that had evaded our attention. Today's report in the New England Journal of Medicine regarding analysis of data from the CDC's National Syndromic Surveillance Program makes it clear that a sharp rise in emergency department visits began in June 2019, and occurrences peaked in September 2019, consistent with our active case reporting from public health departments around the country. Second, we are confident that vitamin E acetate is strongly linked to the EVALI outbreak. In a second report in the New England Journal of Medicine, CDC scientists found vitamin E acetate in lung fluid washings, what we call bronchoalveolar lavage samples, from 48 of 51 patients with EVALI, but not in a variety of comparison patient groups. The patients with EVALI came from 16 different states, suggesting this was not simply a single local supplier of tainted products. These expanded patient clinical specimen results are consistent with previous work, including identification by FDA and others of vitamin E acetate in THC-containing products collected from patients with EVALI, as well as Minnesota's recent report that vitamin E acetate was in seized THC products from 2019, but not in any samples from 2018. Given all of these findings, including today's study, we can conclude that what I call the explosive outbreak of cases of EVALI can be attributed to exposure to THC-containing vaping products that also contain vitamin E acetate. I want to stress that this does not mean that there are not other substances in e-cigarette or vaping products that have or are capable of causing lung injury. We know that a persistent small proportion of EVALI cases do not report use of THC-containing vaping products. Thirdly, the outbreak is getting better. While we continue to receive reports of newly diagnosed patients with EVALI, the level of new cases is greatly reduced and has been declining since a peak in September. This is consistent with our new syndromic surveillance data findings that we're reporting today. There are a variety of potential explanations for a true decrease in new hospitalizations. Unfortunately, despite this improvement, we have new issues of concern to share this week. Fourthly, the reports in today's MMWR summarize our findings of a concerning phenomena, readmissions following discharge from the hospital. We had hints of this earlier this fall, but now have a formal analysis to share. We report on dozens of patients who have a significant worsening of symptoms shortly after being discharged from the hospital for EVALI. Our MMWR article describes 31 patients who were readmitted to the hospital a median of 4 days after discharge, and 7 patients with EVALI who died shortly after being discharged, a median of 3 days after discharge. While we don't yet have all the clinical reasons that these patients worsened so suddenly, we did find factors that may be warning signs of which patients are at greatest risk for these problems. Patients with chronic diseases, particularly cardiac, chronic pulmonary disease, obstructive sleep apnea, and diabetes were significantly more likely to be readmitted. Older age is also likely a factor. Based on these new data and discussions with clinical experts, today CDC is issuing updated guidance to help clinicians carefully prepare for discharge and have a new EVALI discharge readiness checklist among materials that we're distributing today. We also recommend earlier follow-up of patients, optimally at 48 hours post-discharge, to make sure to catch any clinical worsening before it's too late. The 4 reports today have much more detail, which we'll be happy to address in the questions. But I want to stress that this is a serious clinical condition affecting young people across the country. It is completely preventable. The outbreak has required the tireless response of the public health and clinical community. I want to thank all the partners across the nation, as well as CDC staff, for their hard work on this response, and we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Shukit. Christy, we're now ready for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Please ensure that your phone is unmuted. You will be allowed to ask one question and one follow-up question. One moment while we wait for questions to come in. Our first question comes from Dan Varango of BuzzFeed News. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I'm wondering, when will we see some kind of action to remove vitamin E acetate from these things, and can you even do that given they're an illicit product, not like, you know, lettuce that's legally sold and you take action against?
This is Dr. Shukit answering. Let me say that we have put out messages about the concern about vitamin E acetate. As you point out, we haven't been telling people to put vitamin E acetate into these products, and illicit products in many states aren't necessarily well controlled. A number of states that do regulate cannabis-related products have taken steps to make sure that vitamin E acetate isn't included or to even test for it. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Carla Johnson of the Associated Press. Your line is open.
On the rehospitalizations and deaths, is there reason to believe that these were medical mistakes that were made, that people were released too early, and is that why CDC is issuing this new guidance?
I think that I would not say these are medical mistakes. I think it's important to say that clinicians have been working very hard to address a new syndrome responsively and carefully. And what CDC and the state health departments have been doing is trying to gather information quickly and feed it back so that we can continually improve. The vast majority of people who were discharged from the hospital have not been readmitted. But in the 31 episodes of people who were rehospitalized, we wanted to understand if there were any warnings. And so we do think that a more systematic readiness evaluation before discharge and attention to a number of factors that might predict worsening are attended to. So I think the medical community has actually been doing a terrific job with this. But we are committed at CDC to update our guidance as soon as we have actionable information, and that's really what we're doing today. Next question.
And a follow-up?
Oh, sure.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence that these patients return to vaping after going home, the ones who are rehospitalized?
Yeah, thanks. I think there's some anecdotal information in particular states or localities. We don't have that synthesized. And again, we, in a previous MMWR and telebrief, we talked about the very important counseling that should start in the hospital. And this isn't just a medical issue. This is a behavioral issue. And attending to whether it's addiction to THC or issues that really would help a person get off of the vaping products, that needed to be part of the in-hospital care. So we don't have the systematic analysis of individuals, but we do have some anecdotal reports about that. I think it's likely there's a variety of factors here, and the medical conditions that showed up were particularly important to note. And, you know, I think hopefully we'll help clinicians clue into those as they are readying patients for discharge. Next question.
Thank you. The next question comes from Lena Sun of the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Thank you. Dr. Shukit, could somebody walk us through in the vitamin E acetate report, there's mention about how this could be causing the lung injuries. But I was wondering if somebody could just sort of explain that in English. There's a section in there which I did not understand at all. What happens in the lungs that this could be causing the injury, but in layman's terms?
Yes, let me give you sort of a very general layman's terms explanation. And I need to caution by saying we do not know the precise mechanism by which vitamin E acetate causes lung injury. The two theories that were offered in the paper included one that is a chemical change that will disrupt surfactant, which is a material that's on the lining of the lungs, and that might interfere with the lungs' ability to expand. The second is a chemical injury caused by a byproduct of vitamin E acetate. When vitamin E acetate is heated to very high temperatures, it's possible for a substance called ketene, K-E-T-E-N-E, to be released. And that, in old reports, can be associated with some lung harm. So those are two theories. Potentially one or both may be operating, and there may be other possible approaches. You know, from the early reports in the outbreak, there were questions about lipoid pneumonia or lipoid pneumonia and just the sort of oil gumming things up with the macrophage response. So there's a few different possibilities out there, but the two in the paper are really about that interfering with the lungs blowing up or, you know, expanding like a balloon that could lead to some downstream harms, and then the ketene metabolite.
Thank you, and I had a follow-up. Okay. Given that each time you take a look at the lung fluids of EVALI patients and you're finding, you know, pretty much all of them had vitamin E acetate, and now you have a control group where you didn't find any of it, but are you going to be doing more of those comparisons, or is this pretty much, you know, it?
Thank you. This is a really important paper and provides very helpful information. So I think we are of the belief that vitamin E acetate has caused the EVALI syndrome in the vast majority of patients. There are a couple other studies that are in progress, including testing chemicals from individuals who have other lung diseases or other lung conditions to understand the specificity. And then a second would be animal studies. So I don't think we have to hold our breath for those results, but I think they're helpful to really help us go a little deeper in understanding of the problem. We certainly have, since September, been recommending people avoid e-cigarette or vaping products, particularly those containing THC, particularly those, you know, acquired illicitly. But I think these additional studies will round out the scientific story.
But just one more follow-up, Dr. Shukit. So does that, can you now say that it's not in vaping products containing nicotine, since, because
no,
as you said this?
Let me say that my conclusion is that the outbreak, the very large increase in cases above what we have seen as a larger baseline than we realized, is attributed to what was happening this past year in the supply with the vitamin E acetate diluting or tainting the THC-containing products. That doesn't mean that there are not other chemicals or substances in e-cigarettes or vaping products that can or are causing lung injury. And so there's a lot more work to do. The outbreak, this big increase, is largely explained by the vitamin E acetate phenomenon, but that does not mean that vaping products with THC or other substances are safe, and it doesn't mean that e-cigarettes that are nicotine only are safe.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Richard Harris of NPR. Sir, your line is open.
Thanks very much. And this is a point of clarification, please, about the understanding the spike in timing. I just would like you to connect the dots a little bit. If you have a single spike of increase, it would seem as though that really points to a single culprit, and that seems to be what you're saying here. I just want to make sure that I understand that's how you're tying things together. Thanks.
Yes, that's right. When I talk about an explosive outbreak or a spike in cases, the June increase in cases, I believe, is related to increased use of problematic substances that, I don't have quantifiable data about exactly what percentage of the THC-containing vaping products had vitamin E acetate in them at high concentrations. But I believe the practice of diluting THC-containing vaping products with vitamin E really took off this past year. We also know that, of course, there has been some increases in use of both e-cigarettes and other vaping products in the past couple years, including the past year. But I think the behavior was is common, and the contaminated substances, if you will, became widespread.
Yeah, and a quick follow-up. Do you know, have you been in touch with the FDA? Because presumably they've been trying to track down the source of the vitamin E acetate. Do you know if they've made progress in identifying this bolus of contaminants, essentially?
Let me step back from just the FDA and say that there have been enforcement actions around the country taking place in terms of illicit distributors or producers or suppliers. There has been a lot of action on the part of the FDA and DEA in particular locales and other state or local authorities in trying to track back suppliers. There's also been recognition that the Internet and YouTube have been sort of pushing this practice of diluting and making it more perhaps widespread. And so I think there's been action to try to get the vitamin E and other dilutants out of these materials and also to track back suppliers. FDA made it really clear in their investigation and messaging that they did not intend to take enforcement action against a user, but they really wanted to get cooperation in terms of testing of products so that they could do that backtrack. But I can't speak about particular ongoing investigations.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kathleen Doney of WebMD. Your line is open.
Good morning. Can we assume that all cases are down just because the emergency department visits are down? Or is there other evidence that all cases are down?
Oh, thank you. There are several The reports today and yesterday include, today we're reporting on the syndromic or emergency department visits and a few different approaches to using essentially administrative or automated data to look at trends. Yesterday we updated our weekly epidemic curve
that
is really based on the active case finding from state and local public health. And that has also shown this decline. For several weeks, we were reluctant to overinterpret the decline because there's so much work involved with the collection of data from clinicians and states and gathering of the data and pulling it together that we wanted to make sure there wasn't just a lag or fatigue. We do know that some states are sort of batching their reports, and we continue to get reports in from several weeks ago. But we believe that the outbreak spiked in September and that it is decreasing. It is not over. There are still new cases coming, and we do think consumers need to be careful and people need to be vigilant, and public health is still very much focused on this. And this may be a long-term problem for us to make sure that we prevent as much of this serious lung injury as possible. But we have both the active reporting and the syndromic or emergency department visits. That said, there may be some regional variation. It may be that illicit supply is popping up in an area where it wasn't and has decreased in another area. And I think we have to be alert to the idea that there may be new spikes or surges, possibly from other substances that are harmful. This has really been a wake-up call for the public health system and clinicians that there are new threats out there, and that consumers really need to be cautious. And when young people are admitted to intensive care units and perhaps damaging their lungs permanently, I think parents and others really need to take this seriously.
So you're saying it's declining based on those two things, declining reports
correct.
From the states overall and declining hospitalizations.
That's right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Denise Grady of the New York Times. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask you about something that was mentioned in the paper, and that was that there was this gradual increase in emergency room visits by very young patients between 10 and 19, even well before the outbreak really started. And there's a suggestion in the report that that could just be due to the increase in using e-cigarettes, nicotine e-cigarettes. Could you talk about that a little more, please? Is there any more to say, anything you can elaborate about that? And the article mentions there's a need to investigate it further. So will that be done?
Yeah, thank you. I think it's important for us to not overinterpret the gradual rise that the syndromic surveillance detected, including in the 10 to 19-year-old age group. There are a variety of potential theories. Remember, this is a very nonspecific signal, because it essentially is saying that e-cigarettes or vaping were mentioned in a chief complaint. It may be that some of those are nicotine poisoning. It may be that some of those are early EVALI cases. But I think we can't really conclude. It is clear that there was a major spike in September from many different sources, and that in further review of those clinical records, the severe lung injury was identified. But I think we are really actually very excited about syndromic surveillance and its potential to help us recognize threats earlier, and it is likely that most signals will need verification of clinical records and review to make sure that we're separating signal and noise and that we're finding some specificity in what the signal is about. So I don't want to overinterpret it. There will be more looks at potentially what it may mean, but it's intriguing, but certainly not conclusive.
Thank you. Can I ask a follow-up, please?
Sure.
This is just a quick one. The people who went back to the hospital and the deaths, was the 7 deaths part of the 31, or was that a separate number?
Thank you for that question. It's a separate number.
Thanks.
Thank
next
you.
Question.
Our next question comes from Jamie Ducharme of Time Magazine. Your line is open.
Thank you so much for doing this. I was just looking for a little bit more clarity on what could have been to blame for those illnesses, for the Evaluate patients in your new study who did not have vitamin E acetate in their lung fluid, those 3 people who didn't meet that case report.
Right. Okay, so just those 3 patients, right. The article provides a little bit more detail on them, and, you know, the EVALI diagnosis is essentially a diagnosis of exclusion after you've ruled out infectious agents because they can look quite similar. And on further detail, there's some complexity with each of those patients in terms of the finding of some bacteria that the clinicians didn't think were causing the problem, the issue of eosinophils, which can be a sign of fungal or allergic reaction, you know, a lot of different clinical details. And so I wouldn't say that we know what the cause is of each of those, and it may be that they're indicative of a background rate of nonspecific serious lung injury that may be occurring. So I don't think we have a single short answer for that. Dr. Blunt may want to expand on that. Ben?
What we did add in our publication about those 3 additional cases, I defer to my co-authors or additional comment on those 3 individuals.
So this is Jim Perkle. So I just want to comment that we feel like that those 3 patients had clinical courses that could reasonably be explained by other diagnoses, but we intentionally put out a very sensitive case definition in the EVALI response. And so by doing that, we're going to get people that also have some other clinical things going on, and EVALI might be plus minus in terms of their diagnoses. So we had to do that. We think that was important, but we think there's some explanation here for their clinical course that does not require saying that these patients are really EVALI cases, but it's still kind of a gray area there.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brianna Abbott of the Wall Street Journal. Your line is open.
Hey, guys. Thanks for doing this call. Quick question. So when we're referring to THC products that contain vitamin E acetate, what is the sense that how many of these are coming from the illicit market compared to something bought from a licensed retailer?
Thank you. In previous reports, including extensive studies from Illinois and Wisconsin, we have information about sources of where people were getting their THC-containing products that supplement what we've gotten from the national data. And it does appear that the vast majority of individuals report getting their products from informal sources like friends, families, acquaintances, online or in-person dealers. So that doesn't mean that there are not individual, pretty well-documented episodes where the report is pretty clear that a person got a product from a licensed dispensary, but it does sound like there's a lot more protections involved with the way dispensaries are regulated than with the illicit market. And of course, since this outbreak has occurred, a number of states that have legal cannabis markets have been really looking at their regulations to see if they need to do additional steps to prevent such a problem.
Thank you. And quick follow-up. So if we're sort of saying that the conclusion points that the rapid outbreak is mostly due to these THC products, what do you make of the small but consistent percent of patients who are reporting only vaping nicotine-related products?
Yeah, I think there's a couple factors. I think some of those individuals likely have used THC-containing products, and in fact, the New England Journal article on vitamin E acetate, there's a number of individuals in that paper, 11, who did not report using THC, but they found THC in 9 of those patients in terms of the BAL testing. So there's probably some under-reporting. In addition, I think there are some pretty well-documented episodes, anecdotally, where there isn't THC-containing use, but there's e-cigarette or vaping use of other things where people have gotten quite ill with a lung injury that's consistent with our diagnosis. So I think that we cannot say all of the substances, components, additives, or adulterants that might cause harm. You can imagine heating to a high temperature material that is not well regulated could lead to lung injury. So partially misclassification, partially other factors.
Great, thank you.
I think we have time for 2 more questions, operator.
Thank you, one moment. Our next question comes from Eden David of the ABC News Medical Unit. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks so much for the updated information. So I'm wondering, in terms of the trends you've seen in the spikes in September, how much of that do you attribute just to the increased awareness for this potential, cause of illness and symptoms? In that sense, how much of these trends you see are just maybe, in a sense, artificially made to seem bigger just by the fact that providers are more aware of that potential cause of concern?
Thank you. The recognition by Wisconsin and Illinois clinicians in public health that clusters were occurring was critical in alerting the public health system and the nation to this problem. We are pretty sure that the Google Trends spike in searches is completely related to the media attention, and in fact, it followed our first telebriefing. However, when the clinical and public health community began to investigate cases, they recorded dates of hospitalization and when concrete, very careful events occurred, and it is clear that there was a peak in September. I believe it would have gone up much further had we not issued reports. So I think that the peak then is likely due to increasing use of adulterated THC-containing products, and the decrease after September 8th is likely due to changes in behavior and interventions by law enforcement, FDA, and others in terms of the product supply, and hopefully reduced use of risky products. So we don't think that this outbreak is just a question of better recognition, and that is really why the syndromic surveillance is so helpful, because it shows this increase in emergency department visits actually before we recognize the national problem, and the spike in September is probably, as it got worse and worse, more widespread, and there was more recognition, the decrease because of the interventions that have been taken. Last question.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Abby Hagleg of Yahoo. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks so much. I just had a quick clarification question. You mentioned YouTube at one point in regards to vitamin E acetate. Were you suggesting that videos, sort of like DIY, how to dilute your vaping liquid is maybe part of the origins of vitamin E acetate being put into vape liquid?
I'm not an expert in this area, but I would say that communication channels may have led individuals to do sort of copycat. It's pretty clear when you look at vitamin E acetate, it's a goopy, viscous liquid that is pretty similar in goopy liquid viscousness to THC oil. And so if you were kind of trying to extend your THC oil, it would be a pretty good way to do it. So how word of mouth or social media helped contributed to this phenomena, I don't think right now anyone believes it was a single dealer or single producer that added vitamin E acetate to THC oil. I think there's a sense that this was a distributed, adulterated supply. And how that happened, I can't provide conclusive comments, but I do believe there were social media factors that likely played a role.
Got it. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say thank you all for joining this. I do, in addition to thanking the public health and clinical and scientific communities that have been so critical in helping us respond to this outbreak, I really want to thank the media as well, because you definitely have helped get the word out to the public, and this has been a public emergency that really needed your voice. So thank you for calling in today, and our press office has a closing note.
Thank you, Dr. Shugart. I'd like to repeat her thanks, and thank you all for joining us today. If you have additional questions, please contact the CDC Media Office at 404-639-3286 or by email at media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.